Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for the evening. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. We do request that our speakers be allowed to finish their remarks without interruption. Question cards are going to be used, as always, for today's question and answer period. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Akiva Tor is the Consul General of Israel for the Pacific Northwest region. He has served as World Jewish Advisor to the President of Israel and as Deputy Director for Palestinian Affairs in the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Consul General Tor is a graduate of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's written and lectured extensively on Jewish values in the foreign policy of Israel and on ethical considerations in international relations. He served as a paratrooper in the IDF and as an infantry captain in the IDF reserves. Consul General Tor is married to Nomi, a social worker, and they have four children. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Consul General Akiva Tor.
Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club, and this is a timely discussion. My sense of the audience is there are people on both sides of this issue and perhaps sometimes some in the middle. So what I would like to commit to the audience from the beginning is I will speak for about half the allotted time, and we will leave the rest of the time for discussion. I invite your questions. I believe deeply that this is a time for dialogue and also a time of opportunity for betterment in the Middle East, particularly between Israel and Palestinians. And this is primarily what I want to focus on this evening. But I will also talk about the Iranian issue, which is a key issue and also very, very timely given yesterday's Security Council resolution. So let me start with a description of Israel's formal position on the Israel-Palestinian conflict at this time. Our formal position is that there should be two states, a Palestinian state alongside Israel with an internationally recognized boundary between them. The Israeli government, in order to enter negotiations as a condition which was stated by the Palestinian Authority, agreed to freeze building in the West Bank until September. That's a 10-month moratorium. We did not agree with the Palestinian and also the U.S. demand that Israel not build in Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem or in Jerusalem over the 1967 line. Our feeling, our reason for that was the following. Our view is that the Six-Day War took place 42 years ago. There are large and massive Jewish neighborhoods on the other side of the Green Line, which will almost certainly be a part of Israel in any agreement between us and the Palestinians. We do not know how long the process will take, and it's not possible, it's actually not feasible politically for really any Israeli government to freeze building within Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem. We're talking about neighborhoods of tens of thousands of people and building projects which are not politically relevant to the solution of the Israel-Palestinian conflict. This is our view. We know that others did not agree with it, but we were happy that we were able to reach agreement with the Palestinian Authority on the renewal of the peace talks between us. We also acted to reduce the number of roadblocks in the West Bank, and we reduced them from, I believe, close to 100 to a number much closer to 14. And we have had very much a pro-economic policy, as also the Palestinian Authority has had a pro-economic growth policy in the West Bank, which has brought to 8% GDP growth in 2009, and it looks like there will be a similar statistic in 2010 as well. Now, what is unique about, I think, the Israel government position at this time is that this is the position of a center-right government. And we have our government coalition is unique and one which has existed in Israel before, but It's odd also in a particular way. The centrist party, Kadima, which was established after the disengagement for Gaza for the purpose of future disengagements in the West Bank, is in the opposition. The coalition includes, at the center of it is the Likud party headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. At the left of the coalition is the Labor Party, whose formal positions are leftwards of Kadima, the party in opposition. And then we also have parties that are more to the right, such as Israel Our House, headed by Avigdor Lieberman. And we also have a number of religious parties whose political orientation is not clear. It can be many different directions. So at the center, however, of this government, we have the Likud party, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, and he really has, for the first time, it's the second time as prime minister, has adopted formally the position of two states as his policy. Now, here I will take off my hat as diplomat and speak for a moment as an analyst and observer, which is not opposite of being a diplomat, but nevertheless, the positions of this government are not the positions of Ehud Barak in 2000 and of Ehud Olmert in 2007. Those governments were engaged in a very, very deep process with a very advanced stage of peace talks with the Palestinian Authority. And Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert made offers to the Palestinian side that it is unclear that the current government of Israel will be willing to go that far. Olmert said specifically, he accepted the Clinton parameters in Jerusalem. The Clinton parameters basically are Arab neighborhoods for the Palestinian state, Jewish neighborhoods for the state of Israel, and some sort of agreement or some sort of joint management of the holy sites, the Holy Sepulchre, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, the whole area of the Old City, what we call the Holy Basin. And I cannot say to you, the current Israeli government does not have a formal position on this. It's not clear that Netanyahu envisions an offer going this far. Barak also made a similar. Olmert's position was stated in a more specific way. Barak offered approximately 94% return of territories captured in 67. I don't know exactly where our prime minister stands on that right now. But his formal position is a Palestinian state in which we will negotiate on where the border will be between us. Now, I believe, despite a very, very difficult 10 days for everyone, I believe that we are actually in a moment of opportunity. And I say it not only, but in part, I listened carefully to the chairman of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen, speaking on the Charlie Rose show yesterday. And he said a lot of things that I thought were very, very interesting and I believe give reason to hope for hope. When I say reason for hope, I speak on the one hand as an Israeli. But I also speak as a person looking from outside, what are the positions of the two sides? Is it possible to bridge them? And I was listening, and here's what I heard Chairman Abu Mazen say. He said that the Palestinian demand is a full withdrawal of territories captured in 1967, with East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state. However, he also mentioned the Clinton parameters. He did not say that they were his position or that he would agree to them, but he mentioned them. He spoke of the right of return of Palestinian refugees to the state of Israel, which is something which is not acceptable to us. But he also encased it. He said, we insist on the acceptance of this principle, but not necessarily its application. This can be a very, very big problem for the state of Israel, from our perspective, because if the question of whether the right of return exists or not is a question of, is there such a right? And I think that this will be a very difficult, even if it's symbolic, it will be a very difficult point as negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority continue. He mentioned the Arab Peace Initiative of 2007, which is an initiative of the Arab League. It's not clear if all members of the Arab League really subscribe to it, but it's an interesting and important and positive challenge to the state of Israel, because it's the Arab League saying to the state of Israel that for return to the 1967 borders, it also says also for the application of the right of return, which we cannot agree to, the Arab world or the Arab League will make peace with the state of Israel. That is a challenge to us. We have not engaged, every Israeli government has spoken about the Arab Peace Initiative, but we have not dealt with it formally. We've not given a formal answer to it. We have preferred to deal with the Palestinians directly on that, but nevertheless, it's still out there, and Abu Mazen is speaking about it, and I think that's a positive challenge towards the Israeli side. And the thing that I heard from President Muhammad Abbas, which I thought was the most very, very significant for Israeli ears, is he said, I'm looking for an agreement which will involve final claims. That means an end to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And that's very much that's essential for the Israeli side. We're willing to pay a very, very heavy price from our standpoint, but we want finality. We do not want a situation where we go a very, very far away. We uproot lots and lots and lots of Israeli citizens from their homes. We go through a very, very difficult internal Israeli process, and at the end of the day, we have an open-ended process which only opens up again and again. That's very essential for us, and I think the fact that that Chairman Abu Mazen said it is very, very important for the Israeli side, and we need to listen carefully to what he said. Now, I also want to venture a thought and also a hope. I would like to think that the current crisis with the flotilla will actually move the peace process forward and will accelerate the process. And the reason that I think that this may happen is because the truth of the matter is that the Palestinian movement which stands to gain from the current crisis is none other than Hamas. The sides which gain, which will lose will be Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And I think that therefore this current kind of dynamic will push us together, will make us want to find the way to work with each other. I'd like to say a word also about Israel's position regarding Hamas. Our view is not ideological. Our view does not resemble our view regarding the PLO in the 70s. In the 70s, we demanded that the PLO change its charter before we speak. We have not made that demand of Hamas. We have not asked Hamas to change its charter. Our position is exactly the same as that of the Quartet. We will speak to Hamas and negotiate with Hamas if they will meet three conditions. If they will recognize us as a state, if they will recognize the validity and bindingness of the Israeli-Palestinian agreements up till now, primarily the Declaration of Principles and the interim agreement, and if they will say, if they will commit to a policy of nonviolence in favor of politics and negotiation. This hasn't happened. I don't think it's close to happening. Frankly, I don't think it will happen. But if it would happen, we would talk to them, but it would be problematic because it would mean undercutting the Palestinian Authority and injecting ourselves into internal Palestinian politics. In our view, the Hamas rule Hamas is the de facto government in Gaza at this time, but we believe that their rule is illegal. We believe that their rule is illegal because even though Hamas won parliamentary elections in 2006, they did not win presidential elections, and the Palestinian Authority was ejected from Gaza by force of arms by Hamas in 2007. So we try to pursue policies which will strengthen the Palestinian Authority, but without being seen to strengthen the Palestinian Authority. We do not want to undercut the Palestinian Authority. And however, if Hamas will change its positions fundamentally, we do not have an ideological position against speaking to them. Our policy on Gaza, what has it been? What will it be? Our policy has been based on three principles. Principle number one, and the primary principle of Israeli policy has been, since the Hamas takeover of Gaza in 2007, to prevent the entrance of weapons and munitions into Gaza. We view the Hamas rule as an enemy entity, also formally, and we cannot allow them to build up a weapons base in Gaza similar to what Hezbollah has succeeded in doing in southern Lebanon. First of all, Hezbollah is further from our major cities. Hamas, the northern Gaza, is only 40 miles from Tel Aviv, 22 miles from Beersheba. We cannot allow Scud missiles, one or two perhaps already exist in Gaza, but we cannot allow them in large numbers inside the Gaza Strip. We just cannot allow that. That's number one. Number two is the return of Gilad Shalit, or at least access to him through the offices of the Red Cross, the Israeli soldier captured by Hamas in 2006. And the third part of our policy has been to isolate Hamas. And this has been a policy which we have held together with Egypt. During the disengagement in 2005, the Israeli military did not want to cede the Philadelphia corridor to the Palestinian Authority or to Egypt, but Prime Minister Sharon said no. The southern border of Gaza will be an Egyptian border. We will not surround the Gaza Strip. We will surround the Gaza Strip on two land sides and from the ocean, but we will not hold the southern border. That will be Egypt's responsibility. Now, isolating Hamas is something which Egypt also believes in, or they did believe in until recently, because Hamas represents within Arab politics the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a movement within Egypt is illegal but tolerated, and which challenges the regime. Now, on this issue of isolating Hamas, we will have to see what we will do. We have not succeeded up till now. Hamas paid 30,000 salaries in the month of May, which means that they have access to funds. And I think it will be very, very difficult for us to isolate Hamas on our own. Our policy has been to allow the movement of food, medicines into Gaza and to allow agricultural exports. But neither ourselves or Egypt have facilitated the growth of the Gazan economy because we wanted to isolate Hamas. How this will play out now, it's unclear. I believe that policies of everyone are in flux right now. But point A of the policy, keeping munitions from going into the Gaza Strip, that we can't give up on. And it will be a challenge to us, but we will find the way to maintain that part of our policy no matter what, because that is a fundamental policy of self-defense. I think that it won't be easy for us because it requires that we do not allow free transit of ships into Gaza, and it will be almost impossible for us to agree to a policy of searching ships at sea because, frankly, a ship the size of the Mavi Marmara cannot be searched at sea, not effectively. So we have to find the way how to keep the essentials of our policy in place because these are essential for Israel's self-defense. Here I will say a few words about Syria, then a few words about Iran, and then I will stop talking and we will perhaps, I hope, begin speaking to each other. On the issue of peace with Syria, frankly, I believe that both sides understand exactly what the other side requires, and neither of us have been willing so far to meet the price of the other side. Syria's demand is a full withdrawal from the Golan Heights. And it's true that when talks were going on with the Barak government, there was a question of, okay, what did that mean? Does that mean to the shore of the Kinneret, of the Sea of Galilee or not? But probably this is an issue that we could work out. Our demand from Syria is a change in its orientation. We will not agree that there will be peace with Syria, peace agreement, and Syria will continue a strategic alignment with Iran and a strategic alignment with Hezbollah. I would say that on our side, there is not great appetite for dismantling Israeli towns on the Golan Heights and leaving the Golan Heights for what we know will be an Arctic cold peace. And on the Syrian side, there's not a willingness to break off its ties, not its diplomatic ties, but its alignment ties with Iran and Hezbollah. And because neither side has really been willing to walk down this path, this part of the peace process has not gone forward. Now, I'd like Iran. So something quite important and significant happened, and that was the passage in the Security Council yesterday of the fourth sanctions resolution against the Iranian nuclear program. The resolution focuses primarily on the Revolutionary Guard. It is not focused on the Iranian economy as a whole. It targets only one Iranian bank. There are at least five others which are important pillars of the Iranian financial sector, but only one bank is targeted for sanctioning. And Ambassador Susan Rice said the following about the resolution, that it was meaningful, credible, and significant. The word which she did not say is effective. And I think this is because we all understand that the resolution will not be effective. It will not stop the cause Iran to stop enriching uranium. It will not stop the Iranian missile program, and it will not stop the Iranian program for developing a nuclear warhead which can fit on a missile. However, nevertheless, it's a strong statement of the international community, and it's too bad that Turkey and Brazil voted against, Lebanon abstained, but nevertheless, 12 members of the Security Council passed it. A year ago, I think there were many people that were skeptical if Russia or China would be willing to pass a Security Council resolution, and they did. And that shows that the international community is in a different position than it was 12 months ago vis-a-vis the Iranian issue. The resolution did not target export of gas or oil, or the center of the main aspects of the Iranian financial sector. Basically, these are not sanctions which are, they're not crippling and they're not close to crippling. It allows Chinese companies to continue to work in the Iranian oil sector, both to increase exports of petroleum, but also for Iran to increase its refinement capacity internally. It also allows Iran to continue to earn $100 billion a year in oil and gas exports, which is basically the Iranian national budget. So what has it achieved? I think it's achieved the possibility of further steps. And Israeli diplomacy will continue as it has been, but we are not alone on this, to speak to the essential economies of Europe, which are Germany, France, Italy, and England, and try to get them to move past the Security Council resolution to much, much stronger, either an EU sanctions regime or bilateral sanctions regime. And I believe the U.S. government will be thinking about what it can do, and it can do a lot. One thing which I very much hope will happen is the Security Council resolution places a ban on export of all kinds of weapon systems to Iran. And hopefully this will bring about Russia's putting a freeze on the export of S-300 missiles to Iran. I very much hope that will happen. I think I have a few more other issues about the Israeli investigation of the flotilla events, but I think I'll leave that for the question and answer period. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Consul General Akiva Tor. A reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Consul General Akiva Tor for Israel for the Pacific Northwest. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle and the moderator. And in fact, you correctly anticipated we do have a fair number of very good questions. So let's get to them. Let me start by asking you, Consul General, an audience question of what you see as the greatest obstacle to intelligent, constructive discourse regarding conflict in the Middle East.
So the question, I guess, would be which aspects. So I will choose to focus it on the Israeli-Palestinian aspect of the conflict. I think that the major problem right now is a political split within Palestinian society. The fact that the Palestinian Authority is ruling only in the West Bank and that the Palestinian nation is divided between itself over its leadership principle and does not have a strong enough constitutional framework for resolving this split. This creates a great problem because the West Bank is landlocked. Gaza is on the Mediterranean Ocean. Gaza has no hinterland. It cannot be self-sufficient. It has to be linked to the West Bank in some way. It has to be linked to another economy in order to thrive. That can be the Israeli economy through cheap labor. We don't want that. It could be a link with the Egyptian economy through northern Sinai. The Egyptians are not willing to agree to that so far. The only other possibility, and I think the natural possibility, is a link to the West Bank. It would be either through a road corridor, through a rail corridor. There would be some sort of connection, and they would become one economic unit. It would also solve many, many problems. For example, in the framework of a peace agreement between Israel and a Palestinian state, the Palestinians ought to have their own international airport and their own international port. They ought not to have to deal with our bureaucracy or with the Egyptian bureaucracy regarding the export of their goods. But right now, Gaza is ruled by Hamas. And West Bank is ruled by the Palestinian Authority. Egypt has been trying to mediate between the two, but Hamas has not been willing to hold new Palestinian elections. I would say this is a major problem, but my view is that one should not allow problems to stymie progress. We can achieve peace with the Palestinian Authority, and we can hope that if that will happen, that will really affect something vis-a-vis Gaza. A very bad result would be if we achieve peace with the Palestinian government in the West Bank and a Palestinian state is established in the West Bank, and Gaza simply remains as it is. That would be very negative.
There were a number of questions and suggestions on the flotilla. Let's start with this one. The best way to exonerate Israel of any wrongdoing regarding the flotilla is to let an internationally recognized body conduct an investigation. Why won't Netanyahu allow this?
The question would be, who would this international body be? This is a suggestion. Actually, it's the decision of the UN Human Rights Council. So the leaders of the UN Human Rights Council are Sudan and Pakistan. And we're not going to be judged by Sudan. Now, wait a second. And we've seen the results. We believe the Goldstone Report, which was a UN commissioned body, was deeply, deeply biased against us in every way. And we prepared a deep response to it. However, what we do believe is that the issue has to be, there has to be a board of inquiry. It has to be investigated. And the Israeli government is talking with the U.S. government about what would be appropriate international involvement. Appropriate international involvement would mean the participation or the active observation of third parties. I think a U.S. judge or a U.S. general would be an excellent such partner. And we would seek someone else as well. All right. No, it's okay. Guys, please. I think... I'm sorry.
So... civility and substance being two of the hallmarks of Commonwealth Club events, please continue.
Okay, please, audience, let's be tolerant of each other. Okay, I think that Israel understands that there will need to be some sort of international element to the investigation. We believe that we have all of the tools for investigating ourselves at the tactical level, but it is clear to us that 40 other nations were involved, that Turkey was involved. I do not think that Turkey is in a position to be a fair arbiter on this one, but we will find a way which will meet an international standard of fairness.
Here's a audience member's suggestion that they would like you to comment on regarding the flotilla. Why didn't the Israeli Navy, knowing that members of the Al Jazeera press were on board the lead vessel, as well as unfriendly Turkish and Palestinian nationals, simply disable the ship by shooting out the propellers, thereby avoiding the possible loss of life, as well as the public relations repercussions and diplomatic repercussions for Israel?
So I would answer at three levels, although I don't answer with full authority because these are exactly the points which the Board of Inquiry needs to answer. But from the best of my understanding of the situation, I would say the following. First of all, I believe that we had a completely wrong assessment as to what was going on the ship. Otherwise, the force would never have landed in this way. It would never have landed in such small numbers. They had emergency sidearms on their thighs, but it was not the primary weapon. The primary weapon was a paintball gun. I believe that they were... It's not a lie.
There were nine people killed, including an American citizen.
No, it's
stop. Killed. It's murder. Oh, this is nonsense. Paintball.
It's a fact.
A reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Consul General Akiva Tor, Israel's Consul General for the Pacific Northwest.
I would simply say to the gentleman who left that the Bay Area activists themselves who were on board the planes, the ships, saw the paintball guns and testified that's what the commandos had. I heard it with my own eyes in my own ears in the press conference. So number one is we boarded with the wrong mindset and were not prepared. The soldiers were not prepared for what they encountered. And when that happens, you get into a situation where you have no choice except to use lethal force if you want to come out alive. And that is a mishap. And we have to understand how it occurred. The idea about other means of disabling the ship. I think this was the first flotilla which had a ship of this size. A ship of this size, there are apparently serious problems with disabling the propeller. On the one hand, you cannot do it in a way which will possibly sink the ship. If the ship is disabled at sea, that can also be a dangerous situation. Towing it can take days, maybe weeks until you can get it into port if it's not under its own power and it's that massive. So I believe that there were not easy tactical solutions, but clearly there can be a better one.
More generally, after Israel searches supplies for Gaza, what is the method by which that humanitarian aid is transported to the people? Does Israel give it to Red Cross, give it to Hamas, set up its own soup kitchens? How does it work?
Well, what our offer to the flotilla was that if they would divert to Ashdod port, then we would take responsibility for transport of the goods to Israel, to Gaza. And our offer was the following. It would be offloaded in Ashdod port. We would look at it. We would see what it is. If it met our standard of humanitarian goods and not munitions, it would be transported under the observation of the flotilla participants to Gaza. Once it reaches Gaza, there's a question as to how the goods are distributed. Here we have an issue with certain building materials, with concrete and metal beams, steel beams. We're willing for them to enter Gaza, also in large quantities, but we want some international organization, be it a UN organization or the Red Cross or a responsible NGO, to take responsibility that it will be received on the other end and that it will actually go for building, either of private homes or of projects, but that steel beams will not be diverted to a rocket manufacturer and that concrete will not be diverted for building all kinds of fortifications. The other possibility that we said is that if you don't want it to go through Israeli hands, then it can be diverted to Egypt and it can go across the Egyptian border into Gaza. So primarily, to summarize, if goods want to come, we are willing to work with whoever wants to ship them. We will allow their participation in the process. We will allow their active observation, but it has to go either through an Israeli port or an Egyptian port.
A audience member observes the policy in Gaza seems to be counterproductive to the peace process. Comments saying, I'm disappointed in the way Israel has conducted foreign policy, and I say that as a longtime supporter of Israel. Do you think it's counterproductive?
I think that there are people who believe that it's counterproductive. There are Israelis who believe that it is counterproductive, but I would put the following to the questioner. What are our options? What should we do? We could allow Hamas to grow strong and to engage in free commerce and to engage in patronage. In other words, where they would be responsible for the movement of all goods and for them to deepen their political strength within the Gaza Strip and for them to be there for the next 50 years. We could do that. But if we do that, we won't have peace with Gaza. The Palestinian state will not be linked to Gaza. Egypt will, despite what they're doing right now, they will build a 100-meter-high wall between themselves and Gaza. But that is one possibility, but I do not think that it promotes peace. The other possibility is to invade the Gaza Strip, arrest the Hamas government, give them into the hands of the Palestinian Authority as the legal government, and reestablish the rule of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza by force of arms. This step would be very drastic. It would involve massive loss of life on the Palestinian side. And it would be part of the Palestinian narrative for the next 100 years. The Palestinian Authority was established by Israel. I think it's not one that it's one that we are able to do. It's one which would not be wise to do. So what does that leave us? That leaves us, I think, with a middle option, which is to attempt to maintain a standard of living in Gaza which is acceptable, but to isolate this regime. Now, which was the policy choice of the Israeli government, and it's been a difficult one, and it's a question whether it has been successful up till now. In general, I think that we in Israel generally say you can have a million good arguments for a policy. At the end of the day, the question is, does the policy work? And I think that we have to think about this.
What do you think will become of the Israeli-Turkey relationship, which has been so strained in the past weeks because of the flotilla?
Inshallah, it will get better. I would say I'm assuming that the audience are readers of the New York Times, so you've probably read Tony Judt's op-ed piece today. And I think that he blames Israel unfairly for the loss of Turkey. Turkey is an important ally of the State of Israel and an important ally of the West. But the relationship with Turkey has been under stress since 2002. Prime Minister Erdogan visited Israel. I worked in the president's residence when he visited. I believe that was in 2004, 2005. And we welcomed him. And this relationship is important to us, but it's under great stress. But I don't think it's really our fault. Something has changed in Turkey. In 2002, there was a change in the Turkish government. The Islamic Party came to power. It has caused a downgrading of the position of the army but not only of the army, of the military, but also of the judiciary and other parts, other more secular parts of the government. They're losing power in Turkey. Turkey was not accepted to the European Union, even though Israel worked hard. We're not EU members, but we have diplomatic relations with every EU state, and we let it known we believe Turkey should join the European Union. But what can we do? Europe was not willing, and that also has affected Turkey's decisions regarding its orientation. So I think that there is a deep problem regarding Turkey, and we have to do our best to improve these ties. But I don't think that it's really in Israel's hands.
We had several questions have come in dealing with the perception of Israel in the world. Here is one. How do you see Israel winning, or at least not losing, a media war waged by the pro-Palestinian media worldwide? Or as another audience member put it even more succinctly, why is Israel so bad at PR?
So the problem with this question is that I can't answer that actually we're okay at PR, because that answer won't be accepted. I would put it the following. I think that Israel is deeply misunderstood in many quarters of the world, but I do not believe that Israel is misunderstood in the United States. And I think that the U.S. media, for the most part, is presenting a reasonable description of what is going on in the Middle East. This is my view. I think that you should read the New York Times, and you should take seriously what you read there. I was a press attaché in the Netherlands for 4 years, and that is press which is ideological, not in our favor. So I think that there are many reasons for this problem, but our primary PR problem is that when you are one and when there are many against you, you are one voice and there are many voices against you, and there are many other countries whose fundamental interest is to get along with all of the people who you are not getting along with, and even in democracies that filters through. So we have to work pretty hard. We have to make a major effort. I think that we have to be wise and not fall into traps. There is no really good answer to the question.
Here is a follow-up on the flotilla. Please give us the facts about the organizers of the flotilla and their ties to terrorist groups such as Hamas and Al-Qaeda.
Well, first of all, what I wanted to say is the following. I think one of the things which Israel would be wise to insist on in the investigation is that, yes, we should be looked at. It's okay. But I do think that we have the right also to, that the Board of Inquiry should look into Turkey's monitoring of the issue. What is the IHH? Who is the IHH? Who were the people? What actually happened on the Mavi Marmara? Is it true that there were 40 people who closed off the top deck and did not allow anyone else on? Is it true that they boarded the ship separately and with no inspection, and they carried with them boxes of knives? And I think that the answer to this question should be answered in the framework of the investigation, the wider investigation of the incidents surrounding the flotilla. But I do think that it's only fair that anyone who has seen the video of what happened, you can say it's out of context. I don't see how it can possibly be out of context, but let's say one would say that. It's clear that there were people on that ship who were not the Bay Area activists, and not in that mind frame, and not of that worldview. And I think that that has to come out as well.
If Israel is a state born on the basis of a religious homeland, then does every religion that claims a homeland deserve to make that homeland their state?
Israel is not a religious state. Essential position not only of Zionism but also of Bundism, which did not believe in the establishment of a Jewish state, is that the Jews are, and also of the Russian, of the Jewish communists, and to a certain extent the Reform Movement, is that the Jews are a nation. Take that back. Not the Reform Movement, but all the other movements in Europe in the 19th century believed that Judaism is not only a religion, the Jewish people are a nation. And Israel is the state of the Jewish people. It's the nation state of the Jewish ethnicity. It's hard to talk of Jewish ethnicity because we are from every different ethnic group, but we are a world people, and we are an ancient civilization, and it is possible to be a Jewish Buddhist, and it's possible to be a Jewish atheist. Being Jewish is not, it can be a religious category, but it is not primarily a religious category. And that's something which is not understood about Israel. Israel, by some people, Israel is a secular state by law, and it is not a state of the Jewish religion. The Jewish religion has positions of privilege in the state of Israel, as does, by the way, the Muslim religion and the Christian religion, in all areas of personal status. And that's an issue of great debate within Israel, but we are a state of the Jewish people.
Do you think it would be possible for Jerusalem to belong to the world as the first international city?
This was the position of the partition resolution. I hope that it will not be the outcome of a peace treaty between Israel and the Palestinian people. I think that Israel's record in Jerusalem has been a very good one in terms of religious freedom for all religions and for access to the holy sites. And I know that we would very, very much not like to see it fall under some sort of international regime. But frankly, I think it has to do with how we get along with the Palestinians on this issue. And if the peace process will be successful, I believe that the international community will accept an agreement which is worked out between Israel and the Palestinians. So it's up to the two of us.
Number of questions dealing with Iran. Here is one. Why do you think that Iran is a nuclear threat against Israel? Simply having nuclear weapons and capabilities does not constitute a threat necessarily. What makes you think that Iran would wipe Israel off the map as soon as it was able?
First of all, we never said that that would be the case. Our position is that an Iranian nuclear weapon would be very, very dangerous for the entire Middle East. It would destabilize the region. The first thing it would do would be to initiate an arms race, because the major Sunni states would not tolerate Iran's position of a nuclear weapon, and them not. So we would immediately see crash nuclear programs in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, perhaps even in Jordan. That's number one. Number two is the Iranian regime is one which is totally hostile towards us and does not accept our existence, and we do not believe that they should have a nuclear weapon. But our argument to the international community has been that it's a threat to all of you, not only to us. The Iranian missiles can already reach large parts of Europe, and eventually they will reach all of Europe. And the question is whether the European continent wants to be within range of a nuclear-tipped Iranian missile.
Seeing what Israel and the United States have done to Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan, why on earth shouldn't the Iranians have the right to defend themselves?
Who is attacking Iran? We have no common border with Iran. We have a large Iranian Jewish minority within Israel. We had good diplomatic relations with Iran until 1979. El Al flew to Tehran. We had an Israeli embassy in Tehran. We are not threatening Iran in any way, and nor have we ever taken an action against Iran. So I don't know what that means.
Here's a local question here in San Francisco. What role will the Israeli consulate play in defeating the proposed anti-Israel resolution to be presented to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors next week? Maybe you can explain a little bit about what that resolution is.
Well, I learned about this today, and I think it's the job, frankly, of San Franciscans to make sure that this resolution is not adopted, because it's totally one-sided. but it's also not constructive in any way. It doesn't take, San Francisco should be, my view really is that San Franciscans who care about the Middle East and who are passionate about this issue should try to be a bridge between the parties and should not be, should not take sides, and certainly not the wrong side. And I would urge you to urge your supervisors to try to adopt a resolution which will help us, not polarize us. We've got enough forces of polarization at work all the time. But our job is to provide information and I work for the Israeli government, but my job as well is to provide services to any public official who wants information. And we will do our best to be a source of good and fair information for the supervisors. But frankly, audience, it's your job.
A reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker tonight is Consul General Akiva Tor, Israel's Consul General for the Pacific Northwest. As I indicated, there were a number of suggestions as well as questions. Here's one from the audience. Here's a solution: a confederation between Israel, Jordan, West Bank, and Gaza. Your thoughts?
Lebanon.
Okay.
the state that we don't want to be like. The state which was once a great and very, very hopeful country in the Middle East. And which went through a terrible, terrible civil war. In the Lebanese civil war, more people were killed than in the entire history of the Israeli-Arab conflict, by a factor of two at least. We have competing national aims. The Palestinians have their national aims. We have our national aims. Jordan has their national aims. I'm sorry, call us modernists. Call us people from the 19th century who believe in the nation-state system. And that means that we should be good neighbors within the framework of nation-states.
An audience member observes, there's a saying that I've been hearing a lot lately. If Israel laid down its arms, it would be annihilated. If the Palestinians laid down their arms, there would be peace. Your thoughts?
I would say I think that has to be fixed. I don't agree with it in that exact formulation. Amos Oz wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week, which was highly critical of the Israeli government and highly critical of the way we handled the flotilla issue. But he said clearly, I am not a pacifist. If Israel will not have a strong army, it will cease to exist within a very, very short time. He said one day, but I think within a very, very short time. The truth is that if Israel would not be strong militarily, I do not believe that even any of the... since this is for the radio, I won't say that sentence. In terms of the Palestinians, they certainly need an internal police force. Our position is that a Palestinian state should be demilitarized, but that does not mean that it's a weapons-free zone completely. We believe that the Palestinian government should have the monopoly on arms within its own society. And, for example, if we ever want to get to a situation where we can remove the security barrier between Israel and the West Bank, that will require very strong Palestinian governance and a strong Palestinian self-security apparatus. So we do not believe that the Palestinian state should be demilitarized, but we believe that it should have strong executive powers, which include, of course, strong police powers.
Well, Mr. Consul General, you've now mentioned the New York Times three times, so I have to remind our audience there are alternatives here in San Francisco. But I won't give the toll-free number.
I will say that I read the Chronicle every day. And I read all three sections, the Green Section, the Bay Area Section, okay. And Section A.
Okay, I'll throw out these meaner questions. Here's another audience question. How can you achieve peace when Israel continues building settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, There are 500,000 Israelis living in the occupied territories. Do you think that ending the occupation would advance the peace process?
So this question is a question which I receive all the time, and I think that the question can be framed in a way which would be objective, but that's not the way it's framed. Israel is not building settlements in the West Bank. We are not. We have a moratorium on building there. We have to make a decision in September as to whether that moratorium will continue or not. But for the last 10 months, we have not built in the West Bank. We are not expanding settlements. Now, then there's a question of the usage of what should we call building in Jerusalem over the 1967 line? You know, look, we want to see Jerusalem as a united city. We would like to see Jerusalem united under Israeli rule with free rights for Palestinian citizens there. But we also signed a declaration of principles which said that Jerusalem was an issue that we would negotiate in terms of a peace agreement. We would reach a negotiated agreement. But I'm sorry, but the New York Times did say that I read an article about the problem of political editing of language. The use of the term settlement for building a apartment building within a ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Sanhedria, to call it a settlement is a political use of language. You can call it construction, which is in opposition to international law, but it's not a settlement. So to answer the question, if it had sanitized language, or not sanitized language, but fair language, look, I don't know what will be in the West Bank, and I do not know what will be with the Israelis who are living in the West Bank, but I do know what happened in the Gaza Strip. In the Gaza Strip, an Israeli prime minister said, we are going to move forward the peace process with the Palestinian people, and our first step is going to be we are going to disengage from Gaza. And he ordered the removal of 21 settlements and 9,000 Israelis, and it happened. It actually happened within the space of a week. We are a strong state, and we're a successful state, and we're capable of we have a very, very vibrant and messy politics, but we can carry out executive decisions. And I think we've proven that many times. And we want to achieve a peace agreement with the Palestinian side, and we know that there will be a painful price for our society.
We have a couple questions here on U.S.-Israeli relations. The U.S. gives Israel billions of dollars a year in military and economic aid. What does Israel owe the American people for all the financial assistance it's received over the years?
Okay, well, first of all, we do not receive economic aid from the United States. We used to, but for the last 3 to 4 years, we do not. We receive military assistance for purchase of weapons. We receive approximately $2.7 billion a year. 75% of it is spent inside the United States. So it's true that some of those monies are allowed. For example, we're allowed to develop an anti-missile weapon system, which I think will be of great use to the United States because it doesn't exist yet. And U.S. monies pay for parts of that development. But we receive money that enables us to have modern Air Force, which is purchased from your workers and from your factories. In terms of economic aid, we are a debtor nation to the United States, and we have never defaulted on a debt payment. Egypt received complete forgiveness of its debts to the United States in exchange for the signing a peace treaty with Israel. Jordan received full forgiveness of its debt to the United States when it signed an agreement with Israel. The only country which did not receive any pass was us. And we owe a lot of money to the United States, and we pay it back every month. I think the questioner, though, was asking another question. I think the questioner was maybe touching on the issue of, is Israel a liability for the United States, or is Israel a benefit for the United States? I think there are strategic arguments in all kinds of directions, but I think not to miss the larger point. Israel's success is the success of Western civilization, and it's the success of the West. And Israel's non-success is a failure of Western thinking. I don't think that there's a deeper strategic aim than that.
In your view, can proximity talks between Israel and Palestine actually lead to a mutually agreed upon peace? How and is the United States the proper moderator for those talks?
Well, our desire and our wish and our position is that we should move to face-to-face talks as soon as possible. But the Palestinian side does not agree to that. And the United States is a good moderator for any peace process. We need the United States involved. We appreciate the U.S. involvement. It's a very special statement about U.S. civilization because really the United States is really the only party that is able to, that has our trust and has the trust of the Palestinian side. And that's pretty unique. I think it has something to do with fair play in American society.
Unfortunately,
the answer is yes, we will reach a peace agreement. It will happen.
And
I don't know. Between now, but it will happen. It will happen because it's the, first of all, well, I say it as a matter of belief. And hopefully not prophecy, because in the Jewish tradition, prophecy is only for prophets. But having said that, it's the fundamental interest of both peoples is a peace agreement between our sides. And I believe, like Immanuel Kant, that human beings are fundamentally rational. Therefore, it is rational that we will reach a peace agreement between us.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for just one more question, another simple one. Are you concerned about a religious war at some point between an Islamic country and Israel?
I'm concerned about it. The rise of Islamic radicalism within the Middle East, as is everyone. And that's a great concern of all of the moderate Arab states. The best way to prevent this from happening is to keep Iran from achieving a nuclear weapon. Thank you, John.
Well, please join me in thanking Consul General Akiva Tor for his comments here today. I want to thank the audience here for all your terrific questions, as well as our listening audience on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 105 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.